Shelly, why do you look so sad?
I'm not really sad. I mean,
No, I'm telling you, you're sad.
everybody's telling me that. My wife's telling me that. My kids are telling me that. Everybody's saying, like, Shelly, you're so sad. It's like, no, I mean, at the times you're crazy. I don't think I'm sad. I feel pretty optimistic, actually. I mean, not for any good reason, but I'm always relatively optimistic. So yeah, I feel pretty good. I mean, for the world coming to an end, I feel pretty good.
I also think you've been quarantined for so long that you haven't had any sun, and you need to like go outside and get some sun.
And I am very blessed in that, A, there is some sunshine, and B, I'm in a place where you could really enjoy it. So I probably should do that at my earliest convenience, actually. How are
All right,
you?
well, I'm good. I'm ready to start the show.
All right, well, let's do that. I'm Shelley Palmer.
I'm Ross Martin.
And you're listening and watching. Think about this.
The more you listen and watch,
The less you know.
that's true.
Today, we have an unbelievable show because we have the one and only Barak Turovsky, the head of Google Translate, the largest AI project on planet Earth, to talk to us about AI, AI models, AI training models, and all the crazy that goes along with it.
And why do you think right now is the moment for us to have Barak? Because you've known him and worked with him for a very long time. Barak speaks Shelley Palmer, and Shelley Palmer speaks Barak, and I'm immigrating to this relationship. But you, why now? Like, what, we could have had him on any time, but why now?
Well, look, a couple things have gone on the last few weeks that are really, really important from an AI perspective. First of all, Translate is the largest AI project on planet Earth, and it makes sense, right? You've got roughly 20% of people in the world speak English, but 50% of the internet is in English. So if Google had their translation thing really tight, they would just make a lot more money. So they're highly motivated to get translation right. And Barak has been on this project for quite some time, and he's got some of the best AI engineers in the world. But in the last few weeks, we've seen IBM and Microsoft and Amazon all say, hey, you know what? Facial recognition unfairly singles out people of color, and AI models aren't exactly perfect, and we're going to stop doing that. Google stopped doing facial recognition sales to law enforcement in 2018, so the other guys are just catching up.
Well, and Andy Jassy at Amazon Web Services, who I believe listens to our show, he actually admitted, I'm not sure how many law enforcement agencies are using AWS facial recognition.
It's a lot. And by the way, Amazon said they're going to suspend it for a year as the sales to law enforcement. But what they didn't do is say that they were going to claw back or turn off those that they're already selling it to. So whoever's using it is going to use it. But you know what? It's not just Amazon and Facebook and Microsoft, like the really big guys that are doing this. There's little startups like Clearview AI and plenty of others. You can actually, I mean, Ross, you and I could right now go online and in about an hour and a half have a workable face recognition AI model fully up and running, and we could start training it. Now, what they do is they train these models with pictures of bad guys. And so the ACLU did
Wait,
a
wait, 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 stop. I don't think people know that. I don't think people know that. And what do you mean by bad guys?
So there's wanted posters and mug books, right? Like all those mugshot books, like, known people who they take the pictures of, that this face and then that face and, the whole Law and Order lineup thing. So all those pictures from lineups go into the system and they train against the known criminals. So the ACLU did a thing in July, I think of 2018, just a couple of years ago, where they ran the Congress through the system, and 28 Congress people of color were mistaken for criminals. Oops. So it's weird how the models don't exactly fairly represent all faces. It turns out that it's a lot harder to identify the features that AI models look for in people of color. I think there are real reasons for that, and most of it is the skewed data that goes in. And if you put in skewed data, if you get bad data in, you're going to get bad data
Bad
out.
outcomes.
The system itself isn't good or bad. Like, it doesn't know any better. In fact, there's no morality whatsoever to the system. And that's, I think, one of the biggest problems is that we don't even understand the level of bias that we add when we program stuff. I have two favorite examples. One favorite example, there was a study done where they were trying to get an AI model to recognize sheep. Pretty easy. They showed it lots of pictures of sheep. And at some point later, they threw in just the picture of a grass meadow and it was identified as sheep. And this happened a substantial number of times. So what was the bias? Turns out mostly when you take a picture of sheep, you got a small white puff of cottony stuff in a big green field. And so the computer model looked at the green field with little white tufts in it and goes, that's sheep. It had no idea what a sheep was because it has no context. So predominantly, what is it looking at? Big green fields, and the little white tufts were inconsequential. So at a certain point, it doesn't recognize the sheep, it recognizes the field. Another example, which is significantly more unfortunate, there was a lot of buzz about, hey, AI can identify melanomas, certain kinds of skin cancers. So when you get a picture in a doctor's office, they usually put your arm up and a ruler next to your arm, and then they shoot with a very professional camera, very well lit down to see like what this thing is. And so that's a professional picture. When you take a picture with your smartphone, you put your arm out and you shoot it with your smartphone, or someone takes a picture, send it to the doctor. So the model was getting all kinds of accolades for being incredibly accurate about predicting certain kinds of melanoma. But it turns out that the bias was not to the melanoma at all, but to the ruler. Because when people get a shot professionally taken with a ruler, there was a very high percentage. If you're in a doctor's office and a doctor's taking your picture, you already think there's something wrong, and there probably is something wrong. Whereas if you just shoot a picture at home, it could just be a mole. And so again, the bias wasn't towards any kind of important part of the melanoma or any kind of cancer research. It was to the ruler. So when you learn stuff like this, you realize that we often don't even understand the biases that we program into these tools.
Right. And that is why he needs to be on the show today, because absolutely, when we talk about systemic change, or we talk about systems of oppression that have existed for a long, long time, and now in this moment of reckoning in the United States and around the world, we're starting to look at those systems and say, whoa, that is the oppression. That's where it's coming from. And so, look, I know Barack and Google are not going to go into race, ethnicity in this conversation. He's not going to go there.
But I don't think so.
But still, what he's going to talk about is gender and other inherent biases in AI systems and how to root them out. Because machines left to their own devices, as you say, have no morality.
None.
It's our job to program that in.
And you know, it's interesting, Ross, because when we think of the idea of programming something in, we're making an assumption that somehow, some way, you write some code and that the computer responds to that code. But that's not the way an AI model or a machine Correct. Learning model works. Correct. There's a set of guidelines that the AI learns from. There's rules that you give it, like you could teach it to play a game and it'll continually play that game by the rules and it will optimize for an outcome.
Sure, we've all seen War Games with Ferris Bueller in it.
Exactly. So optimizing for an outcome is a better way to think about this, because if you anthropomorphize AI, it immediately takes on that idea of, oh, it's, you know, C-3PO is, you know, an AI. No. This is optimizing for an outcome. And if you give it the wrong rules or you don't specify the outcome really accurately, you can be unfortunately surprised by the results.
So let's bring Barack out here. I mean, he's one of the most brilliant thinkers we know.
We are so lucky to have you here today. Google Translate is such an important project, and you have done such an amazing job with it. And I know you have restrictions on what you can talk about today, so I'm not going to ask you questions that you can't answer. But the good news is, The good news is that AI models and training sets all work fundamentally the same way. So the bias you're going to describe for me today, I can extrapolate and just lay that on to every other bias problem because computers are funny that way. Therefore, I can, and actually more importantly, Ross can ask you really important questions that he wants to ask, and you can say, yes, but, and then you can just take us through whatever you want to take us through, and it's actually going to be the right answer, even though you're not on the spot. That was my nefarious plan for bringing you on today.
Thank you. And thank you for your understanding. And yes, there is a lot of similarities how languages work and let's say visual recognition works. So a lot of the stuff that we're discussing is applicable for other things as well.
So Barak, one of the things I've learned from you, which I did not know before, and since this entire show is about how to get us all to think differently and question our assumptions, is that the inherent bias in language really surfaces very quickly when you do translation. For example, I may be saying, I'm looking for a doctor. And in English, there's no gender assigned to the word. But in almost every other language, that gender is assigned and it's male. So if I'm in Russia, or if I'm in the Middle East, or if even if I'm in France, the doctor is a guy. It's a man. And if you're a woman who became a doctor, you might be better than all the guys. But the gender is what it is in your language for that profession.
Yes, it's exactly right. And I think I want to kind of step back and explain some of the challenges inherited to some extent societal and historical challenges in languages that being picked up by AI. And maybe one semi-unique part of Google Translate that there is a lot of quote-unquote training data labeling work that was happening over thousands of years because people were translating and putting it somewhere, publishing, putting on the internet, etc. And Google uses the crawling techniques to find any publicly available data. And we pick up all of this. That's why Google Translate is so amazing. That's why we support 100 languages that cover 99% of world online population. That's why we have more than 1 billion users, because we support so many languages. But we pick up those biases and they happen everywhere. And just to expand on what you just said, a lot of our sources literally date thousands of years back. For many languages, the biggest source of training data is the Bible. And we have all this data over the years, recent data, old data, that all part of this giant training scheme, if you will. And as you mentioned, historically, professional doctors, as an example, was open to women maybe 100, maybe 200 years. Before that, it was exclusively male. There are professions like nanny that was predominantly exclusively female for thousands of years. So language picks this up and you have those biases. And I will give you an example. Russian has a notion of doctor, of gender in the language. I'm Russian, so I can speak about it. If you tell a female doctor male, she would be totally fine. It's kind of gender neutral approach. If you'll come to a male doctor and you'll tell them, address them as doctor female, they will think you're a bit crazy, right? It's completely unusual way of using the language. So language, rules of language, to some extent are biased on its own, and it's happening for thousands of years, right? And all this is picked up by machines. And obviously, if you use statistical approach, there is 99% of male doctor versus female doctor, and all this picked up.
So Barak, as the language evolves, there's this concept of preferred pronoun now, which is a very inclusive way to think about all people. But it hasn't infiltrated the body of work the way it has sort of made it to the spoken word, right? So you see it in Twitter a little bit, you see it on the social posts a little bit, and occasionally you see it in print, but mostly this is what you've learned to do now in public to
That's
be respectful
exactly right.
of the people you're dealing with, right?
Yes, and the thing about this is like, there is no they in Google Translate yet. Like the machine has not learned what they is.
Exactly right. So just if you step back again, as I said, I don't think Google basically took a stand. Yes, it's a societal bias, it's deeply ingrained bias, but it doesn't mean that Google as a leader in AI shouldn't be responsible of doing something about it. And we specifically publish a principle that one of the most important principles is we will not create or reinforce existing unfair bias. I also want you to understand AI or any machine task is a bias, because if you need to do face recognition, you focus on training on faces, not on hands.
I gotta stop you. I don't understand what, I love this. I think it's an essential conversation. What do you mean by an unfair bias? Because if you've grown up in a culture which for centuries has decided that this is a man's job and this is a woman's job, I, coming from where I come from, might believe that's a terribly unfair bias. But if you grew up in it, you're honoring your heritage. That doesn't feel to you like an unfair bias.
You nailed it. It's some of those biases are societal and they're developing. Race bias was normal many years ago and it's not normal now. So let's start with like what's called protected categories, right? So the first step, by the way, even that is difficult because protected categories in the US is very different than protected categories in other countries if they even have them, right? So all this, the definition of the problem is a challenge, right? But what I say is that I don't think we can get a pass, Google or anyone else, to say, oh, this is much bigger societal problem. Let's not do anything. We still want to take a stand and do something because we do understand that training models pick up race bias, gender bias, other biases. I will give an example today. Recency bias, maybe it's not an unfair bias, but like COVID, we now have a major task of improving translation quality for COVID-related queries because most of the time machines don't know what COVID is, right? And like a lot of the terms that we use today were used for many years, not in the context of COVID. So they might be even a different meaning. That's why I want to make sure that you guys understand system needs to bias on something, because if they do face recognition, they will focus on faces. That's not unfair bias by itself. But there are things, race, gender, sexual orientation, etc., that are considered, let's say, most of the society potentially unfair. And even that, I don't even want to go there. Which part of the society, what they consider, etc. But like the easiest way to start is to say, okay, there are protected categories, at least in the US, that you cannot, let's say, in fair housing, you cannot discriminate by race, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera, et cetera. By the way, that was a big societal change. People don't remember. Maybe some of you do. In the 70s, it was a big change. You cannot discriminate people based on race. A lot of people push back, oh, it'll be difficult. We need to put all those training to our staff. This is a big societal change, but I don't think technology could say, okay, it's all society. We shouldn't do anything about it. Like, let society decide. So back to your question about what do we do? First of all, I think the question is, in addition to defining the problem that we kind of discussed a bit, and it's not a done deal, as I said. Using US-centric approach is good for US. It might be very different in other countries. But then you ask, what's the right thing to do if you have this situation, that has this bias, that you bias professions based on history, and now there is many doctors who are female. So is it fair to call he's a doctor and she's a nanny? I think it's unfair. But the question is, what do you do? So the first, there is multiple options here what you can do. The first thing that we historically did, let the training data vote. And that's what we got. 90% of the time, doctor is male. According to statistical approach in our data, the right translation is male. Look, there is 10 times, 10 or 1,000 times more male gender doctors in our translation than female. Okay, but that's, in my opinion, not satisfactory, unfair. Then you can take a random approach. Look, we cannot use only male. Let's just flip the coin and let's say 50% will be male, 50% will be female. That's, in my opinion, very random, also doesn't work. The next one is what I kind of touched a bit is, okay, let's approach new gender rules in this particular case that let's say were developed by, in France, there is an economy of language that started to address this issue. Here is the problem. Google Translate or Google in general covers a lot of people that have a lot of different needs. Most of their needs are very simple. I need to write an email and I need to put the right thing. All those new rules, even if they exist, let's assume they do, which is not true for many languages, they're very new. The problem is the language. Language develops very slowly. And the example I gave you in Russia, if tomorrow Russian Academy of Language would say you need to approach a male doctor as female, they could say whatever you want. If you come to a hospital and start doing that, people will look at you and say you're a bit, you know, out of your mind. And I don't think they will care what Academy of Languages say, because language is the development of many years, of decades, hundreds of years, centuries, a societal development. So this to me, it's like, it's not going to work, because people are saying, I just want to write an email. You're giving me all those weird things that I don't even know what it is. And I don't care about what Academy of Languages say, even if it exists, right? So we decided in this particular case, to some extent, change the task and give people more choice and more control. What I mean by change the task, usually Google Translate, it's like a calculator to some extent. You ask a question, you get a response. And most of the time, frankly, that's what people want. Yeah. They basically want, I want to translate something. I ask you what it means. Give me the translation. I will copy paste and I will use it, etc. In this particular case, it's trickier. And we basically tell them, look, if we understand this is a gender ambiguous query, we will give you two options to choose from.
When you do that, like generally, AI models work on their own. And there aren't any conditionals, because there'd be a billion conditionals. Like, human beings are amazing at conditionals, because you have your own worldview is what imposes the conditions on your thought process. But there are no such conditionals in AI. It's just scoring for the best outcome. So is there additional programming you do? And is that in somebody's control? Or are you training another model to like make the, like, how are you actually doing that? Because it sounds like an awful lot of work and a big recipe for being a short-term solution to what I think is a long-term problem. So how are you guys dealing with that?
Great question, Shelley. You obviously look at AI a lot. I hear a lot of people, what's so difficult? Just show a toggle of male and female. It's so easy. Why Google hasn't done it? It's so easy. And actually, to your point, it's super hard. We actually had to train not one, we had to train three separate AI systems.
Wow.
Just for that purpose. Yes, and I will go through them just to explain them in a high level. The first one, we actually need to detect gender-neutral queries. That sounds easy. Oh, this is gender-neutral, but like AI doesn't know what's gender-neutral, what's not. The second thing what we need to do, actually need to generate gender-specific translation. And there is a lot of, it sounds easy, but it's not. And then the last thing, you actually need to check for accuracy, whether what you translate actually makes sense.
Here's the thing that I find so hard about your job is, literally everywhere you step, there is a landmine. So you have the most fraught job at the most fraught time, arguably, this century. So I don't envy you. I hope they pay you so much money. I don't know what you make, but it's not enough.
It ain't enough.
Not enough. Because here's the thing, like everything you're doing, like if you make a mistake, there are victims. If you make a mistake, or you don't look at something or teach something to the model, the system doesn't, the system hurts people. But if you get it right, the system helps people. How do you know the difference? Like, what kind of feedback do you get? And when you get feedback that something's wrong or you've missed something, who do you turn to for guidance ethically? Because every day you're sitting on an ethical dilemma every day.
Yeah.
What are you supposed to do?
So we have internally also an ethics board that look at those things as well. My approach is that if you have a protected category, it actually does not matter whether 99% of people don't care. You cannot do it, period, right? You cannot unfairly bias people, period. And you need to deal with it. Now, again, it's a trade-off.
Language is really local. Dialects are local, and they conform to the tribal reality of where they are. You've even seen it evolve. I have a friend, a linguist friend of mine, who looks at Twitter dialects regionally and tribally, because even the abbreviations in the way that people shorthand on Twitter tend to be regionalized and tend to be tribalized to the groups that they are serving, and they evolve. And certainly the internet has shown us certain things, you know, from LOLs and IMHOs, like, TLDR, yeah, too long didn't read. I mean, there's plenty of those abbreviations that are kind of ubiquitous, but there are really tight, little tiny abbreviations everywhere in shorthands. Is it outside the scope of a company like Google, or is it past our science to be able to localize this? It seems like to satisfy everyone, you can satisfy no one. And while it's noble to say the 1% matter, because they really do, it is also an almost impossible task to, when you're looking at scoring stuff statistically, say, well, 99% of the time it's this, but for this 1% use case, which may end up being the 99% use case in 10 years, but language doesn't go at that speed. So,
or now, or next year, shall we?
You're right.
That's what we're seeing.
Or it could be next year. And so what is the, is there a way to break this into smaller problems, or is this translates just so big and so ubiquitous? And like, how do you think about that? Or am I asking the wrong question?
No, you're asking the right question, and looks like you guys are getting more and more understanding of the complexities of addressing this. And look, even before, if you look at biases, if you look, for example, choice of languages that Google Translate support, it's always a trade-off. It's a trade-off because you have X resources in terms of like people, training data, etc., and then you look how many people you actually can serve.
What can other AI professionals learn from what you have learned?
Yes, clearly defines the problem. It's super complex, and make a decision where you start, because it's a never-ending journey. You need to start somewhere. Instead of saying, I will not do anything and I'll wait for society to catch up, define the problem and start.
Barak, the thing I really struggle with, and Shelley and I talk about this one natural resource that seems in very short supply, which is trust. You're a great dude. You're a scientist, you're a father, you're super ethical, as far as I can tell. But like, you've got a team of a lot of people working for you around the world. Like, how do you expect, how are we supposed to trust that this is all just, I mean, I'm emotional about it because if you get it wrong, or if there's a bad actor in the mix, people may never ever realize what happened, but the world will be changed for the worse. So how do we trust you?
To me, it's part of this kind of higher level social contract between, you know, tech companies and users, because at the end of the day, the contract should be, we are committed to take actions when we see something not working. And we're implying everything we can. It's a journey, it's a process. And the more feedback we get from users, not only on gender, like people give us feedback, your translations are inaccurate. That happens every day. And we use this to fine tune and improve.
I agree with you, but you have to acknowledge that the social contract itself is provoking existential questions. Like your social contract and the way we feel about Google is informed by how we feel about what's going on with Facebook. So when thousands of Facebook employees walk out because they believe that their values are different than the values of their company, or that the social contract has in some way been breached, which, by the way, has happened to you, has happened to Snapchat, has happened to every tech company, that makes it difficult for all of us just to say, well, Barak's a good guy. I'm sure he's going to do what's best for the universe.
I believe, Google believes, that we cannot just say societal problem, we just pick whatever is there and just show it. We have responsibility not to create and not to reinforce unfair biases, even if they're deeply ingrained in the society. But if they're unfair, if there's protected categories, we need to start somewhere and do something. We're on a very early stages of this journey. It's definitely not resolved because, as I say, it's a societal problem. But I think our responsibility as AI leaders to say, we will start making steps in that direction.
Barak, I got to tell you, thank you for that. There are certain people who run certain social media companies who I am going to just cut the last 10 seconds of your speech and send only it to them, because you couldn't have said it better, and I have never heard it articulated better. Yeah, it's a societal problem, but you have a responsibility. And thank you for taking that responsibility. And thanks to the people at Google for letting you take that responsibility. Translate's an amazing product. I don't know that I could professionally work as fast as I do without it. It's really quite spectacular. We didn't get a chance to talk about how it evolved, and I think we'll do that next time, because when the world calms down a little bit, and I hope that it does, one of the most interesting things about your job is how the technology evolved while you were at the helm. And I really want to tell that story. But for today, Ross and I cannot thank you enough for being here. You are an amazing guy with an amazing job. And thank you for metaphorically laying out what our actual technological problems are with respect to social media, pattern recognition of all kinds, without us having to make you actually go out there and yell at certain people. So thank you for that. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Barack. Hopefully enjoyed it, and looking forward to talking more to you.
Shelley, every time we have Barack on, I come in with a bunch of questions, and then he blows my mind, and I've got a whole new set of questions. So I feel like we should just give him the whole podcast and just let, we'll take the rest of the year off.
Yeah.
And just, but I don't think Google would let him do that.
You know what, Ross? One of the things that I took away from this conversation, maybe more now because it's so out there, this is what's happening everywhere. This is the problem with all AI models. This is the problem with all training sets. And it's a super common, and yeah, you couldn't blame society for all of society's problems. That's probably the right thing to do. What I love about what Barack is doing, and by proxy, what Google is doing, because he works for Google, is they're taking baby steps. They're doing what they can. They're very smart people, and they really understand that this is impossibly hard. And they're not shying away from it. They're just dealing with impossibly hard.
Well, and remember, we did not directly address issues of race and ethnicity with him.
No, and for good reason. We don't have to. It's inherent in the AI bias.
I want everyone to understand why we did not address that directly, because he could not go on the record to talk about that stuff.
No, he couldn't. But it's important to note that in 2018, Google decided to stop selling its facial recognition to law enforcement worldwide because they recognized the problems they were having with the technology to a large extent because they are the world leaders in artificial intelligence and machine learning, and they understand the imperfections and its impact on society. And they were out front of that. And so, you know, got to give Google credit where credit's due, because all the other big tech companies just caught up this week.
Just so everyone's clear, though. When we were asking about gender and using gender as essentially the proxy for what we're really talking about, that was not us letting Barack off the hook. We were just finding the way for him to actually open up to talk about the complexity of the challenges that we all face.
Yeah.
In translating, so he's talking about the world. If he were just to talk about the United States, it's an unfathomable set of problems, as we are all feeling today.
And you know, Ross, I'm optimistic about technology. And when I asked him about limiting it, it would never occur to me personally to limit innovation in any way. It's not in my worldview. I know there are people who feel like there is good tech and bad tech. I'm not one of those people. I believe that technology is inherently neutral. Human beings are good and bad. You can use a hammer to build a house. You can use a hammer to hit someone on the head with it. Your choice
with
the hammer.
But Shelley, do you trust Google?
I don't trust anyone. I don't want to even single out Google. I am so concerned about the imposition of other people's worldviews into the technology. And it's not just Google. They are doing the best they can because, after all, they're providing a service, right? You cannot deny there is a value to you taking a phrase in a language you don't know, typing it into Translate and getting at least a rough translation, and nowadays even a better translation than they used to have. So that's really valuable to me. And when I put a paragraph in, do I get the meaning? What I've learned with using Google Translate, and I wish I could translate, no pun intended, this to other areas of my life, which I can't. When I put a paragraph into Google Translate and it comes back, I know two things. Either A, I get what the person meant, or B, I need a real translator who will understand the subtlety. So what it tells me is what I don't know as much as what I do know now. So I'll look at a paragraph and it's from an email and I get it. It's like, okay, they've acknowledged that we're going to do this project. Oh, wait, they're asking for something I don't understand. Perhaps there's a language translation issue. Call up a, you know, an expert in that can read the subtleties into this. Translate is easy to do that with. Face recognition is not. Other pattern matching is not, because I won't know what I don't know. It what translates an interesting example, because I can trust that I don't trust it. I'm immediately skeptical that the translation is going to be any good. When something face recognizes, do you start by saying there's only a 63% chance that that's 42% accurate? You don't do that in your own mind. You go, oh, that's that person. So when you use Facebook face recognition in your photos, so it figures out when you're tagging, you know, it assumes that you're you, and it's like that is uncannily good because it's a small training set that's optimized for you. It's not trying to optimize all of Facebook, literally all of Facebook, against your pictures. It's looking at the pictures you take and you've named them, and that gets, that's a much easier, simpler task, especially with the number of pictures people, as you know, Ross, you and I both, if you didn't take a picture of it, it didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
Right, it didn't happen. Like, I, whatever this weekend was, oh, there's no pictures on Instagram. It clearly didn't happen. So we're in a different world now. Translate is a beautiful metaphor for what should be possible, which is, oh, wait, I'm skeptical of that. I don't trust this translation. How many times do you get that option in real AI environments? And the answer is none.
If you think you know less than you knew before, just wait till our next episode.
You've been listening to Think About This with Shelley Palmer and Ross Martin. You can subscribe to the audio podcast on Spotify, Apple, Google, iHeart, or wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. You can find our video episodes at thinkaboutthis.tv. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram at thinkaboutthis, and you can learn more about us on the web at thinkaboutthis.fm. Thanks so much for listening. If you think you know less than you did before, just wait until our next episode.